Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Several times a year, a story about an abused or neglected child makes headlines. What's even more sobering? There are tens of thousands of cases in Massachusetts each year that don't make the news. But for those children who do make those headlines, there is a predictable pattern. An investigation, often resulting in charges, promises of reform, and often a reorganization of child welfare agencies responsible. But Jill Lepore, in a recent issue of The New Yorker, writes that child protection is trapped in a cycle of scandal and reform. So we're wondering, can that cycle be broken? Joining us now with more is Harvard historian and New Yorker writer Jill Lepore. Jill, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You start your New Yorker piece with the case of Bella Bond. And of course, she's the tiny child who was found in a garbage bag on Deer Island last year. But you write that it reminds you of the case of Jennifer Gallison from back in 1978. Can you remind us of that case?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most people in the Boston area heard the story of Baby Doe, who was found on Deer Island and later identified as Bella Bond. I grew up in Massachusetts, though, and everything about the story all summer long, when there were billboards across the state with these kind of computer-generated likenesses of the child asking people, do you remember this child's name, I just kept thinking about Jennifer Gallison, who was a little girl of that same age, whose body was never found in 1978. It turned out she'd been killed by her mother and her father in Somerville and during the blizzard of 1978, which is, I'm sure, why I remembered it so well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember everything about that blizzard, as many Massachusetts residents do. And the more I thought about that, and then I dug around in the case records and the clinical reports and the fact-finding commission that Governor Dukakis commissioned at the time of the Gallison catastrophe or tragedy, and it's just a very, very similar story in many ways.
Well, so can you outline some of the similarities? I mean, they go back to even similarities between both the mothers in these two cases, between Denise Gallison and Rochelle Bond.
Yeah, although I should say, you know, what the public knows or what is publicly knowable about Rochelle Bond is quite limited. She's facing trial, and I think it's important not to draw any conclusions about what can be known about her because it's such a scanty record. But it's absolutely the case with Jennifer Gallison. Her mother had herself been in the custody of the state, taken away from her family when she was an infant because of abuse and neglect. So this is long, sort of, the cycle goes back and back and back. What's striking not only is the repetition and the ongoing cycle of neglect and abuse is the way the press contributes to the problems with the child welfare movement by paying attention to these sensational, terrible, tragic deaths every once in a while and then telling a story about them that actually undermines the work that the child welfare workers are trying to do rather than improving it.
Undermining it how?
Undermining it in the sense that one way those stories work, I mean, first of all, it's important to say the story of this cycle doesn't go back just to 1978, which happens to have been the year that the Department of Children and Families was founded in the wake of the Gallison disaster. It was founded as the Department of Social Services, and then it was later renamed in 2008 in the wake of yet another child tragedy. It was renamed. But the child welfare movement itself goes back to the 1830s, really. I mean, think about the story of Oliver Twist,
mm-hmm.
that Dickens wrote, as a way to call attention to England's poor laws and the way children who were orphaned were suffering from them, that there's this continuous effort of the press to call attention to the terrible suffering of poor children in such a way that blames their poor mothers for their fates. And so the interests of children, poor children and poor mothers are separated repeedly in the way the press covers these stories.
Yeah. Well, actually, Jill, since you mentioned Dickens, I mean, let's step back in time to the 19th century, because I mean, just about every Dickens story I can think of does highlight or feature the hardships of children in, you know, who were basically thrown about in the wake of the Industrial Revolution in England. I mean, even Dickens himself at one time, if I remember correctly, in reality, as a child, you had to work in a boot blacking factory.
Yeah, we can talk about, I'd be happy to talk about Dickens forever. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Oliver Twist is the first novel in the English language whose hero was a child. I mean, it's an important transformation in the history of childhood. But one of the things that goes on in the 19th century, in the UK, the National Association for the Protection of Children is formed as a kind of sister organization for the National Society for the Protection of Cruelty Against Animals. And they're both part of a kind of growing middle-class Victorian sensibility about the need for the middle class to protect the vulnerable, those who are cast aside as a consequence of the ravages of the Industrial Revolution, but also to impose their values on them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of sort of taking away poor children from poor mothers because the poor mothers are neglecting those children, but they're actually taking care of their children in much the way that the middle class did before the middle class was formed. In other words, it takes a kind of transformation in ideas about childhood and the, you know, preciousness and innocence of childhood for this shift to first take place. But then there's a great deal of piety and sanctimony that's associated with it. I mean, there's a lot of heartfelt reform, but there's also a kind of viciousness towards women, towards poor women in particular.
Isn't this a theme that continues on through the cycle of scandal and reform, as you write about in The New Yorker? I mean, in a way, you pinpoint it. You say the tragedy of the child welfare system lies unnoticed at the bottom of a chasm that divides American politics.
Yeah, and this is a really hard thing to discover because the more you learn about the child welfare system and you talk to people who've been working in this, I interviewed a lot of people in Massachusetts or in other parts of New England who've been working in child welfare for decades, since the years of Galison or earlier, since the 1960s, the war on poverty, when people had a lot of optimism that childhood poverty was the next thing to be eliminated, the next thing to be struggled with and faced. And yet there was a real shift in the early 1970s from helping to combat poverty raise families out of poverty and thereby improve the lives of children, to instead, because this was far more politically palatable when the kind of public support for the war on poverty eroded right around 1972, to instead combat child abuse. There's this kind of really pivotal moment when Walter Mondale, who'd fought for universal child care as part of the last piece of the war on poverty, that Nixon vetoed that legislation, and Mondale said, well, even Richard Nixon can't be in favor of child abuse, and so they put through this child abuse regime, which is what we have in place now, where there's a huge state apparatus, I mean a massive, massive state and federal apparatus, to go into the homes of people who are suspected of harming or neglecting their children and remove the children from those homes. And what's not in place, so there's all this incredible, incredibly expensive intervention mm-hmm. that's known to be quite unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And then there's this really scant and diminishing funding and attention for prevention. So we know, for instance, that a very high percentage of children who are removed from their homes before the age of 3 or before the age of 5 end up in the juvenile justice system, end up in prison for much of their lives. So, you know, there's a lot of alarm about the carceral, you know, the so-called carceral state, but because there are people that are calling attention to that and are advocates for the reform of sentencing, harsh sentencing, and racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. But that is fed by the child welfare system.
Well, Jill Lepore, let me just jump in here for a second,
yeah,
if I could, because I'm curious about something. In reading your article and hearing you now, it's impossible not to think that, you know, child neglect and abuse are awful in and of themselves, but they're also frequently, or our interest in trying to do something about it is frequently paired to the fact that they seem to be the inevitable outcome of deeper societal problems, as you've pointed out, like poverty, etc. And our focus on those underlying issues waxes and wanes. But I'm wondering, you know, in your research and your study of the history of child welfare, you know, as we've known it for more than a century, why is it you think we can't get it right? Why are we continuously trapped in this cycle of scandal and reform, as you say?
I think that's a great question. I think we have a similar dynamic in, say, you know, the so-called war against drugs, where I think that's maybe to some degree turning lately, but for a long time, you know, the harsh sentencing guidelines that were meant to just punish offenders was touted as the solution, when that you know, we now know really doesn't work, and there's much more of a turn towards prevention, or understanding that the cost of a system that incarcerates people for, you know, for small drug offenses far outweighs the benefit, and it actually doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't reduce the usage of the usage of illegal drugs. That turn hasn't come in child welfare, and I think there are a lot of reasons for the way in which it has a distinctive cast to it. One is, you know, it really does fall between the cracks of positions on the right and the left. Mm-hmm. So on the right, the big, in fact, the intellectual descendants of the child protection, the Victorian child protectors, is the pro-life movement. People who, you know, those people see themselves, the people involved in that movement see themselves quite, you know, clearly as protecting children. They're protecting unborn children. But their concern, you know, the concern of that movement structurally, you know, begins at conception but ends with childbirth. And on the left, there's a lot of support for the investigation of possible child abuse and sexual abuse. It aligns very well with a feminist position, a sort of almost feminist dogma that, you know, that abusers must be found and punished, and the traumatized must be treated with mental health care. But the idea that something other than abuse is the root,
right,
is the root of that of what happens to children, really just hasn't got that much traction.
Well,
and, you know, and as people have said all along, children don't have natural advocates; they don't vote.
That's right. It's someone must speak for them. Well, Jill Lepore is a history professor at Harvard University and staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. We've got a link to her most recent New Yorker piece. It's entitled "Baby Doe: A Political History of Tragedy." That's at our website, radioboston.org. Jill Lepore, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.